The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is a former Treasury Secretary and one-time president of Harvard University, Larry Summers. Now, remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Now, you also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So please tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, 3-Day Blinds, Naked Wines, and NPR in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, Larry Summers, renowned economist, Treasury Secretary, President of Harvard, where he now teaches. Larry, with you, there are unlimited topics to talk about, but let's start with Harvard. Trump clearly wants to crush Harvard to send a message he can take on the biggest and the best and the richest. He wants to take away all federal grants, trying to ban foreign students, and has called on the IRS to take away the university's tax exemption. This is all about politics. And I think from what I hear, Harvard has a very good legal case, but there are reports in the New York Times and elsewhere that time may not be on Harvard's side in a very costly and endless fight. Do you think Harvard can hold out, or will it have to capitulate at some point and strike a deal with Trump?
I don't have inside information as to the university's plans. Here's what I do know. The Trump administration is proposing to do is completely extra legal, no due process, nothing, completely extortionate. The penalties they're exacting, stopping foreign researchers from being able to cure cancer, have nothing to do with the alleged crimes about humanities professors shouting anti-Semitic things, and that this is casting a huge and damaging shadow over all of higher education, as foreign students, for example, are scared to come to the United States. This is the biggest gift we ever gave British and Australian and Canadian universities in terms of competition. This is the biggest gift we ever gave China in terms of goodwill. So I don't think Harvard has any choice, given that it's got a $50 billion endowment, given its reputation, given the kind of network it has. I think Harvard has no choice but to resist. And so I'm very proud of what Harvard has done. I urge them to do it. That having been said, Al, I think you are right that one hopes that with the leadership of the judiciary, that a way will be found to resolve this conflict. Because there are huge concerns about the way great universities run. There aren't enough people with conservative views around. There's been much too much identity politics. There has been a emphasis on particular concepts of social justice. I heard a story yesterday, I don't know if it's true, but it could have been true, that we have these genius stem cell researchers at Harvard, and they were running what was a fantastic stem cell program. They'd gotten it started when the federal government wasn't funding stem cell research. They were finding cures for all kinds of diseases. And they got a visit from a dean, dean's office, telling them they couldn't keep talking about two genders, men and women. They had to use some other set of language to refer to the spectrum of people.
Oh, Jesus.
I heard a story about this one I verified extensively. We have a great initiative with a brilliant guy who's going to win a Nobel Prize someday in quantum science. And on their website, you know, it goes about the initiative and it talked about quantum science and computing and quantum science and materials, quantum science and employment opportunities. And then it had an equal size section on quantum science and Black Lives Matter. And that's just not the way we should be doing things. So there's a lot that the university ought to do to reform. There's a lot that's reasonable for the government to be pushing the university to do to reform. So I hope that some judge is going to step into this, tell the Trump administration that they're out of line, but also recognize some places where Harvard has reforms it needs to make and broker a solution. Because this war is, I mean, Harvard will be okay in the longest of runs, but we're going to make slower progress against diseases. We're going to have a less competitive economy. Kids whose dream was to find opportunity by coming to the United States to study at universities are going to be completely alienated from the United States. And China is going to be picking up the pieces.
Well, Larry, you know, I don't believe this administration, frankly, gives a damn about anti-Semitism. I think it's an absolute phony excuse. But anti-Semitism at one point was rampant in Harvard. They had a study on it. You have talked about it at great length. I guess my question is on that and some of the subjects you just raised, how much in the aftermath of October 7th, progress or how much changes or what steps has Harvard taken to address these missteps?
Here's the painful and unfortunate truth, Al. If you took the agenda that I thought was necessary after October 7th, Harvard did 10% of that agenda between October of 2023 and February of 2025. Since then, in response to what's been happening, or at least observing what's been happening, Harvard has done half of that agenda. They've replaced politically biased actors who are running big centers. They've put discipline not in charge of professors who love to do juror nullification, but in the president's office. They have scaled back some of the DEI stuff where, like the story I told you about the Stem Cell Institute, where it was just going a bit crazy. They have clarified that there are certain kinds of protests you can do and certain kinds of protests you can't do in terms of intimidating people. So they've really done a fair amount. but they did it slowly and a bit reluctantly. And I'm not proud to say that. And it's a difficult aspect of the story. But look, you are right. Donald Trump is a guy who's had multiple meals publicly with Holocaust deniers. He's a guy who told his vice president to make friends and speak up for the neo-Nazi party in Germany just a month ago. He's a guy who called the neo-Nazis in Charlottesville a fine group of people. This is about a pretext for attacking a kind of elite institution that he finds it attractive to culturally oppose. Yeah. And it's really important, and I think that I want to say one other thing. It's really important to keep some sense of perspective here. Look, I think that Harvard and other elite universities have gone too far with some of this DEI stuff. There's been a kind of reverse discrimination that hasn't been attractive. But it is not one-tenth the sin that George Wallace standing on the door of the University of Alabama, blocking people from coming in and studying in a high school or a university was about. This is not Orville Faubus in Arkansas. This is not the University of Mississippi in 1964. So yes, there is pushback. There should be a pushback on some of the excesses. But when I see the kind of railing against this, like it's some kind of egregious racism, that is a failure to understand and recognize what racism was in this country and in a few places still is. And I think that's badly, badly wrong. And my great fear is that because this is all pretextual, it's really an excuse for attacking somebody they want to attack, that they're actually going to set back the cause. Because for people like me, and there are many of us who think that we need to reform, we need to redress the balance, it's much harder to make the argument when the people on the other side can say, you're just echoing the crazy Trump administration.
Yeah, no.
And so it's making it, this is emboldening every hyper-progressive in the academic world. And that's just an unfortunate byproduct of what they're doing.
That's fascinating. Let me ask one more question and turn over to James on the ban of international students. I suspect the courts will throw that out, that he can't do that for all sorts of reasons. But he can make it difficult. He can drag out the process of visas and other things. You know, in a parallel of sorts, the Supreme Court almost 7 weeks ago ordered the return of a migrant illicitly deported into El Salvador, and the administration has done nothing. Larry, I don't believe these people believe in the rule of law. So even if you win that case in the courts, I think it's going to cause Harvard problems for a while.
Yeah, no doubt. And look, I think that any sensible person abroad is not just going to think this is only Harvard.
Right.
They're going to think it's Harvard this week, and it could be whatever other university we're talking about next week. And that means we're going to lose, coming to the United States, the immigrants who start half our great companies. That means we're going to lose the immigrants who are behind a substantial part of our scientific progress. And that means we are going to lose incredible goodwill. I want you to indulge me in telling a story. We won the Cold War. We won the Cold War because of Mikhail Gorbachev. Mikhail Gorbachev's two big ideas that won us the Cold War were perestroika and glasnost. He did not make up those two ideas. He got those ideas from a really prominent political advisor he had. You might call him the Russian Carville, a man named Alexander Yakovlev. Alexander Yakovlev spent his life as a communist, but then he dismantled the Soviet Union and the Soviet Empire. And people asked him afterwards, where did you get that idea? Why did you do that? How did you know that this was wrong? And his answer was, I saw the United States when I studied at an American university and studied what Franklin Roosevelt did to save the system in 1933. And that's when I realized how profoundly Russia had to change. And I did everything I could to make that happen. If we had been closed to Americans, to foreign students, that would not have happened. And what a profound thing. If we were 1%, if that was 1% of winning the Cold War, it justified everything that we did. Take another example. Xi Jinping's daughter studied at Harvard in 2011. Didn't use the name, did it anonymously, but it's come out since. Spent 4 years as a Harvard undergraduate, living in our houses, interacting with our students, taking our courses. Surely that kind of influence has to have been a thing the United States wants. And why are we throwing that all away? Aren't we proud of our country? Don't we want people to see and experience our country? Aren't our universities part of what is best in our country? By the way, if you look at trade competitiveness, exports and imports, just like it's an export when a tourist goes to Disneyland, it's an export when a student comes and studies at our universities. This is one of our largest industries. This is one of our most competitive industries. This is one of our industries that pays people very, very well. Why aren't we working to improve our trade surplus in higher education? There are a lot more people in America who want to work in higher education than God knows want to work assembling iPhones. So why aren't we doing that? I mean, why are we rewarding Vladimir Putin and punishing the Ivy League? What possible logic could that be as a way of advancing our national interests? I just can't understand it.
James Carville?
So I just want to make a point. Bradley somebody told me this morning, I read a Paul Krugman piece, and he was in Lubbock. 80% of the graduate economics students at Texas Tech are foreign students. Could you imagine the percent of engineering graduate students at Georgia Tech that are foreign students? They couldn't live without them. Okay? Purdue could not exist without foreign students coming
and
studying engineering.
Why don't we want to have all of this tremendous talent? I mean, these are the people who are talking about the importance of excellence, the importance of competitiveness. Why don't we want this? Look, take another, let's put it in another more, maybe even most elemental way. Without immigrants to American universities, it would have taken 4 more years to win World War II because there wouldn't have been any radar. There wouldn't have been the Manhattan Project and the atomic bomb. And I mean, take the names, John von Neumann, Leo Szilard, Enrico Fermi. These are all immigrants. And without them, we would not have had the technologies that won the World War II in the way that we did. And we haven't seen our last struggle. And why do we want to deny ourselves all of this?
I think an immigrant taught physics at Princeton at one time.
Albert Einstein.
But might have, yeah, you might have heard. So, Larry, I have to ask you this. During the Clinton administration, you remember, we were obsessed with debt, interest rates. We wanted to send signals. I remember that shit like yesterday's when I said that to the Wall Street Journal. God damn, I want to beat a bond market, as everybody talks about around here. How we're seeing these, I mean, eye-popping numbers that they're coming up with in terms of the amount of debt that we have, and not only that, how much they're going to increase this. And there's a thought that, you know, well, Larry Summers and Bob Rubin are green eyeshade guys, you know, or then you hear these people say, as long as you borrow in your own currency, you can't get hurt by your own debt or something like that. Should we be worried about this coming explosion and what could be the effects of it? Or are we just being nervous Nellies here?
James, the world's greatest debtor will not forever be the world's greatest power. I promise you that. James, if we want to worry about being dependent, I'm a lot more worried about being dependent on China to hold our debt than I am being dependent on China to buy beryllium or lithium or some rare earth. This is setting up a massive dependence on our part. And, you know, I'm not going to go into all the numbers unless you push me to. But the debt, the debt relative to our income right now is three times as high as it was when Bill Clinton became the president in 1993. And the projected deficit is far higher than it was when Bill Clinton became the president in 1993. It's the problem, I would say, is two or three times as big as it was when the Simpson-Bowles thing got launched in 2010. We are not paying attention to the first law of holes. Stop digging. We are not right now near a sustainable path. And the big, beautiful bill is actually a prescription for prescription for deadly dangerous decline bill is what it ought to be called. And we're going to adjust. And the question is whether we're going to adjust with a plan or whether we're going to adjust chaotically under pressure. We are, I'll say this, there's a thing in politics called a Liz Truss moment. She didn't last very long.
No, she didn't.
I think the famous line was she didn't last longer than a head of lettuce.
Right. Front page.
We are asking for a Liz Truss moment. It may not come this month. It probably won't come this month. It probably won't come this year. But if we go on our current path, I think it's more likely than not that it will happen during this presidential term. And they're doing, look, there's some things that are hard. Raising taxes, that's like complicated. It's like difficult. People hate it. Social Security, fixing entitlements, people depend on it? Those are complicated and difficult issues. Here's some things that I don't think are very complicated. If the IRS hires one more auditor to audit affluent people, that auditor brings in $5,000 an hour when they work in extra revenues. And that's before you think about all the deterrent effects.
And Trump is getting rid of them.
And these guys want to cut the IRS budget in half. I think their plan's going to cost the country $1 trillion over the 10-year budget window. Here's an idea. We've got treaties that serious people in office negotiated that says our bank will help you by asking our banks to give you data on your tax cheats, and you give us data on our tax cheats so we can enforce. The Trump Treasury trying as hard as it can to abrogate and move away from those kinds of agreements. So there's low-hanging fruit to collect revenue and fix these problems. Look, we need to be going the other way. This is something Joe Biden got right. Joe Biden thought it was outrageous that there were 100 people who earned $10 million or more in the mid part of the 2010s who didn't file a tax return and didn't get noticed within the statute of limitations. And that's part of why they enhanced the IRS. Not only is the Trump administration backing off all those enhancements, it's cutting the budget to way less than it was before. And what are they looking for revenue? Is it really a good idea to raise revenue with a sales tax on toys that parents buy their kids at Christmas? Is it really a good idea to push the cost of a smartphone up by 50% or 100%? You and I are still going to have three, Al, but it sure matters for a lot of people in this country when you do that. Is it a good idea to push the price of a new car up by $4,000? These are ways of financing the government that are about as bad as you can imagine. And that's before you get to the fact that other countries will retaliate. I mean, this is a play where you injure yourself in practice, carrying out the play with no defense. And then when you try to do it in the real world and countries retaliate, it gets much worse.
So to use this for an education moment, a teaching moment, I can see these polls and say, what party is better on the economy? And the Republicans are always ahead of us. Very rarely are we ahead of them. And I'll see you on the lecture circuit and people say, well, I believe in empirical evidence. You know, I believe in, is there any reason that a person based on historical performance, okay, of a macroeconomic statistic would not vote Democratic every time? Is there a single macroeconomic indicator under Republican president, Democratic presidential candidates since World War II, since the 1960s, since the Cold War? I don't care how you figure it. Or they even tell us about the difference of economic performance between the two parties.
I first studied this in 1988. I wrote an op-ed with Roger Altman in the rather futile effort to elect Michael Dukakis that compared Democratic and Republican administrations between World War II and 1988, and we said that the Democrats were always better. And people said, well, you know, it's a short sample. You don't have that many of them. It's only been 40 years. Well, now it's been another 40 years. And the 40 years since we wrote that op-ed, the advantage of Democrats over Republicans has even been bigger than it was when we wrote that op-ed. And look, I want to be really clear about something. Yes, it's true that the unemployment rate is lower, the poverty rate is lower, the number of Americans working is higher when we have Democrats. But here's what's in some ways even more surprising. Corporate profits are better. The stock market is stronger. And so the capitalists did fantastically when Bill Clinton was president. The capitalists did fantastically when Barack Obama was president. The capitalists did fantastically when Joe Biden was president. The capitalists didn't do as well, but they did better when Jimmy Carter was president than they did when Richard Nixon was president. And they did better when John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson were president than they had when Dwight Eisenhower was president. And they sure did better when FDR was president than they did when Herbert Hoover was president.
So it's just
there as a fact. But look, our party has to understand some things. We cannot be the party of completely open borders. We can't always look for the next rights issue. Sometimes we need to celebrate the phenomenal things that have happened with the leadership of progressives and not turn equality into equity and not always be looking for the next frontier issue. And look, we need to be for growth and jobs. We were wrong to be against pipelines. We were just wrong. We were wrong to be against natural gas exports. We were wrong not to be for all sources of energy that made our economy stronger as we evolved to a cleaner, greener economy. And I'll tell you something else that's really important to me, James.
Go ahead.
Probably with your help, Bill Clinton always used to say, I want there to be more millionaires in America. Because if there are more millionaires in America, there'll be more people starting successful businesses, employing large numbers of people, and making America a stronger, better country. And that needs to be the Democratic attitude, that we want a rising tide that lifts all boats. And yes, we have a special concern with the smaller boats, but our strategy for helping the smaller boats can never be destroying any part of the economy. We need to get back to that attitude, and we need to stand for strength. And if we're able to do those things, I think we'll have an easier time bringing people to our side.
Oh, thank you, sir. Now, I've just heard it. I've been like this, but you didn't hear from old Louisiana Hack Carville. You heard from a tenured professor at Harvard when he was 26. If you want to make money, vote Democratic. You want to get paid, vote Democratic. I can't thank you enough, Secretary. It's just a big on it. I would remind both you and Al that my last two graduate assistants at LSU, one was from Russia and one was from Greece, and they were pretty goddamn good.
This has been a fascinating conversation, Larry. I must admit, I didn't go to Harvard, but boy, I got a great Harvard education today. So thank you very much, and let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You know, there's a lot of talk about the economy and Joe Biden, as there should be, but let's not forget the Trump lawlessness and recklessness. There's so many targets. But Trump 2.0 has three legs: destroy the libs, revenge, and greed and grift. If you're rich and willing to share your riches with the Don, name your ticket. He pardoned a crooked sheriff who sold badges to well-off constituents so they could avoid traffic tickets and gun laws. But thanks to the New York Times, the story of Paul Walchuk is sleazier. He was just sentenced to prison time and a fine for tax cheating. He ran nursing homes and withheld more than $10 million of pay from nurses, orderlies, and doctors. He used that for personal use, yachts, fancy clothes. He really is a deplorable. But of course, he was pardoned by Trump after his mother, I think her name is Elizabeth Fago, a MAGA donor, attended a $1 million a head dinner for Trump at Mar-a-Lago. You know, if you're rich, you just name your ticket. You can get away with it.
Yeah, the problem is, Al, we have the drinking, you know, from a fire hose. That was just unbelievable. But the whole thing about the Bitcoin thing at the club, the whole thing about going to the Middle East and establishing all this, the Times is really, they're trying to catch fallen knives everywhere. And I think they're doing a good job. I'm not a reflexive defender of the New York Times. Certainly I don't reflexively attack it either. But man, they are doing some real work out there. And I know a lot of these other news sites and news organizations are kind of strapped. But I hope everybody gets on this corruption thing, because it's everywhere. What they do is just do it right out front.
Nothing like
it. If I'm doing it right and open, how can it be bad?
Right. No, it really is unbelievable. You know, and I'll tell you, I think praised the books on Biden's tragic election bid and AIDS covering up his condition. Four of those authors are Washington journalists: Jake Tapper, Alex Thompson, Jonathan Allen, and Amy Parnes, I think it's pronounced. I like Jake Tapper, but when he said this is worse than Watergate, you know, all he's doing is peddling books, but his book is important. But I want to say this: the four have an opportunity now, because they say rightfully the press wasn't vigilant enough. Now, let's take a look at Trump's cognitive decline, which biographer Tim O'Brien says is very real. A prominent neurologist told me, the bravado, ignore that. That doesn't cover up potential cognitive decline or dismiss it. Look at his West Point address last weekend, you know, wearing a MAGA hat and selling those young adults. But he talked about at West Point drag shows and trophy wives, along with veiled racist attacks. Then 2 days later, he wished a happy Memorial Day to all, including, quote, the scum who are trying to destroy our country and U.S. hating judges. You know, much of the press may have missed some of Biden's age-related decline. I'm proud to say we did not, James. But don't miss two in a row.
You know, the thing about Trump is all of this. There's just so much of it to digest. And I understand people's frustration. And, you know, now, I don't know if you saw this, the traders on the Florida stock market call him Taco. Because he's got changing on the tariffs, you know, every day. And you couldn't imagine somebody calling Taco Biden or Taco Obama or Taco anything else. I mean, he's becoming, and the question is, we are in a race of time. What comes first? That people that really come to understand the how deep and profound a fraud and a liar and a crook he is, or he ruins the country. This is a race against the clock. It really is. And I think those of us who understand just how hideous and horrible this whole thing is, we got to find out of all of this, the weaker attack points. And I'm really want to explore these veterans cards as a potential issue, because there's so much you can't break through. It you know, it's like Steve Bannon said, we're going to flood the zone with shit. Was he right? We flooded.
Well, they've done that, and that also they've done that with the legal cases too. I think by and large the lawyers the judges have been very good, but they're getting overwhelmed, James.
Right. It's just so much. It's so much.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So, I don't know if you've ever heard of a Fox News personality named Riley Gaines. But Riley Gaines was a swimmer. She's from Tennessee. She was a swimmer at the University of Kentucky, and was way better than average. I mean, I think she qualified for the Olympic trials. So, and she's about what you would expect. So at the University of Maryland, Jim Henson, who's a graduate, Jim Henson is probably the most influential, five most influential people in early childhood development in the history of the United States, okay? He's such a fucking big deal, you can't imagine. And he tragically died young. I think it was like 53. And my daughter was just telling me the impact that he's had on, in positive impact. So the students, him being a very long Terp alum, and I've always loved that place because I gave the commencement speech back there some years ago, decided they were going to have Kermit the Frog, one of the most creative, interesting things, totally tied to the university, totally made sense. And she went ballistic. And she's so stupid. I hope, by the way, other people over there I know, like Jesse Waters or Sean Hannity or even Laura or Martha McCubb, I hope y'all listen to this and know how dumb this person is, because she's really dumb. And shit, but this is just woke going straight. Do you think some aerospace engineering graduate wants to hear about how to connect with other people? Yeah, I do. I think engineers are human. I think they'd like to connect with other people. I think they'd learn something in, you know, a lot of these people that are graduating University of Maryland aerospace engineering probably grew up being interested in some of Jim Henson's characters. God, these people are so damn stupid and vacuous and idiotic, attacking Kermit the Frog. Jesus.
All right, James, I'm going to talk about something different. Charlie Rangel, a 23-term congressman from Harlem, died this week. Charlie was an original, an exuberant man who loved the business, ranging from his time on the Judiciary Committee that voted to impeach Richard Nixon to later as chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. Like some other veteran members, he got caught up with ethics rules and he was censured. But he was an effective politician who never forgot his constituents. But I want to tell my favorite Washington dinner party story involving Charlie. Vernon Jordan hosted a dinner party maybe 25 years ago for UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. I was seated between Charlie Rangel and Republican Senator John Warner, who, of course, had been married to actress Elizabeth Taylor. Despite different parties, they were friends, both Korean War veterans. Rangel leaned over and said, "John, there's a question I've always wanted to ask you." "What's that, Charlie?" "When you're married to an actress," Rangel began, "and you're doing it, how do you know they're enjoying it and not just acting?" Without hesitation, Warner replied, "That was the problem, Charlie. You can't beat that."
No, you can't. He was a good guy, Warner was. Charlie was great. He was a great raconteur, man.
He was wonderful. And he never, you know, I forget the other street, but he was born on 32nd and something in Harlem. And then he moved for the rest of his life when he was an adult to 35th and the same something. Charlie never forgot his roots. And he was a damn effective legislator. And Republicans, even though he was a dying-the-wool liberal, you couldn't help but love this guy. I'm not sure that'd be the case today.
I know, man, Bush 41 loved Charlie.
Exactly. I just can't imagine the Chip Roys, the Mike Johnsons of the world, appreciating Charlie Rangel. Charlie was, I think,
41 and Mike Johnson.
17 years old when he, went to Korea and enlisted in the Army and went to Korea. But he and Warner were really good buddies. That's a question a lot of people would like to have asked John Warner.
Yeah. Telling you.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Now for our listener questions. I think they get better every week, James. Tommy in Marietta, Georgia says, "When it comes to reading political tell-all books, how do I know what I'm reading actually happened versus the author's cherry-picking information to put in their books to further a narrative they want to tell?"
Well, I mean, I think more often than not, I don't can think of many. Some are incomplete, perhaps. Some may emphasize the wrong thing, but I think most of these books that come out, or to the extent that the author can, that her or his point of view, I don't think they make things up, okay, that very much.
Yeah.
But, I think everybody's talking about the Jake Tapper book. I think for the most part, everybody knew the story.
Right. I think all three of those books, James, you're right.
Yeah, the other books that came out. I mean, we pretty much, look, we know what happened. Okay. Right. He was slipping and people, he wanted to run for re-election and people didn't want to deal with it. And you know that, you know everything.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Jennifer in Ventura, California says, why don't we have age limits on senators, representatives, judges, and presidents? We have minimum age requirements. You know, Jennifer, despite the stories of Biden and the sad stories of Dianne Feinstein, and now I watch 90-year-old Chuck Grassley as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I'm against age limits. If we tell the story well, and we haven't done it sufficiently, certainly in the case with Biden, it's up to the voters. I'm not for term limits and I'm not for age limits, but I am also for younger candidates by and large.
I agree. And I do think, but one of the youth movement, and okay, I understand that, and people getting frustrated, and but most 90% of this goes on in plus 20 or more D districts or areas, and you gotta. I just want to be very careful that we make the distinction between primary and a running in primaries or running in general elections. And, you know, look, the voters, and with Joe Biden, 80% thought he was too old to run. Shit, the term limit was right in every goddamn poll right in front of your face.
Right, right, absolutely.
And the Democrats were just stupid to not pay attention to that. And the problem was the voters were trying to tell us something, and we didn't want to hear it, so we chose not to listen. But I understand the question, but now there's less need for it than ever because age is becoming a dominant talking point. And I'm going to say this very clearly. The Trump people are going to live to regret the focus on age and cognition. Watch
you,
the next 3 years.
You absolutely nailed that, James. Smith in Portland, Oregon says to you, Democratic messaging might have taken down Doge, but it seems to be fragmenting quickly. What is the next rallying issue? Medicaid? And if so, are the likes of Chicago and California undermining our case?
This is very, very important. First of all, thank you for your question. Democratic messaging had nothing to do with bringing Doge down. Doge brought Doge down.
Right.
It was an idiotic, stupid, jackass thing. But by the way, the effects of it are living with us forever. Democratic messaging. A political party really does not have a real message without a presidential candidate. You could say that the Republicans did in 94 with the Contract of America or whatever. But so this is very important. So I ran in to Della Volpe. I'm here at a conference in Los Angeles. John Della Volpe, frequent guest of the show, but friend of the shows. He polls the youth vote at the Harvard Youth Project, which is the gold standard of all youth polls. Among 30, do you know when it says which party is better for men, Republicans or Democrats? You know what percent say Democrats? 10%. And he also told me that far and away, the biggest issue, the biggest negative on the Trump administration and the Republicans, and it's really big, and it's bigger than everything else, is, drum roll please, cutting veterans. And telling you, as with Gerstein yesterday saying, you know, we need to put in every poll, which of the following concerns you the most? And the deficit increasing $4 trillion, kicking 8.5 million people off health insurance, shutting, you know, damaging such essential service of weather service, or cutting veterans' benefits by 40%. The veteran shit just explodes out there because it says everything about who you are and what you are as a party.
Yeah.
And I found that, I didn't find it surprising. I always thought it was a big issue, but he said it disposed everything else away. And I think that's an important piece of intelligence that Democratic messaging should do. And I'm not sure, I'm out here at this conference in California, and I'm beat it like a drum. And I mean, there's some sense of people say, well, you're a veteran. So he said, first of all, 2 years of Marine Corps, I mean, veterans benefits or anything like that. And the fire watch ribbon in the toilet seat and all the chesty puller. But the point is, there's this contract that a country has with its veterans. That is, you come in here, hey, look, you're not going to pay you very much. You got, you know, a sailor on an aircraft carrier works 84 hours a week. Did you hear me? 84 hours a fucking week. And that person, when they're in the Navy, if they get hurt, we take care of them. They retire, they get sick, as we well should. That's a contract we made with them. And that, and people understand that at a gut level.
I'm going to pick up a little bit on that in a slightly different way, because Chris in Franklin, Tennessee asked, where's the Democratic leadership? We hear nothing from them. The movement to dictatorship is real. You know, I hear those complaints a lot. I think last week that the House Democrats, Akeem Jeffries and the Democrats, actually did a perfect job, if you will, of playing the role of the minority party and messaging. Number one, they made the Republicans work like hell to get their bill through. They wouldn't let them sneak it through. They had to have a 1 o'clock in the morning Rules Committee meeting. And number two, they raised the issue throughout the week about basically cutting taxes for the rich in order and paying for it by cutting Medicaid benefits for working class Americans. So I hear the criticisms, but I think what that Republican bill did last week is as good an issue as the Democrats are going to have. And I think they did a good job. Whether that continues or not, we'll see. But on this one, three cheers for Akeem Jeffries and company.
Well, thank you, my friend from Franklin. For those of you who may not be up to snuff on Civil War history, it was a site of a rout where Sherman sent General Thomas up to follow John Bell Hood, and John Bell Hood did not do very well at Franklin. Look, the question from my friend in Franklin, for any Democrat, are we trying to win the summer? Are we trying to win the election, right? And when you're in an election cycle, every day is a fight. Right now, we have no power. They're passing stuff. We're doing a pretty good job of making it difficult for them, where people are getting to see this. We got to put a lot of sunshine on what they're trying to do and got to make it very difficult for them to do it. I agree with you. Right now is, you know, the time to that they're going to walk in right into traps. Get your messaging down. Get your timing down. Know your votes. Know your calendar. They got some terrible votes ahead of them.
Right.
I mean, really bad.
And James,
make them walk the plank.
You are right. And don't get distracted. Stay on this. Stay on it.
You're not trying to win the summer.
Right.
You're trying to win the election. And that's part of, and I understand, a natural inclination is, let's fight them now. Let's go fight them in the valleys and fight them on the beaches and fight them in the mountains and fight them on the prairies and fight them right now. And fight, 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 fight. No. Be smart. And when it's time to really fight, really fight.
Right.
Just you're identifying them and you're identifying yourself now.
Okay, James, this was for you. Nessa in Fairfax, Virginia. I love some of our governors, but Rahm has humor and has a degree of distance from Biden Harris without having to do much. Is he the best candidate or should we be up front? I'm not sure our party would elect a Jew.
Well, first of all, I think our party would. It doesn't matter because, you know, we nominated a Jewish vice president in 2000, and I don't think it cost us 2,000 votes.
I agree.
So that's kind
have
of
a, have a Jew as a governor of North Carolina and senator from Georgia.
Yeah, I understand why people think that. I could certainly understand why if I were my age and I was Jewish, I'd certainly have that thing. But I just don't think it's that big a deal. I could be wrong. And, you know, and they keep saying, well, can we elect a woman president? Doesn't matter because we're going to keep nominating women, and we should. I don't want any choice in that. But if you nominate good people that can really communicate, it really makes a difference. And, boy, we're gonna see this coming up.
Yeah, no, I agree. Mike in Brawley, California says, is Trump required to pay for this Qatari plane and all the security upgrades? If not, where does the money come from for the upgrades? Mike, it comes from you. It comes from you, the taxpayers. And it's going to cost a hell of a lot more than $400 million, not to mention the incredible ethical transgression here. But of course, that's par for the course. But don't think for a second that this is a free gift. It's going to cost Mike in Brawley, California, and James in New Orleans, and New Orleans, and Albert in Washington. We're paying for it, baby.
That's not going to, even though they're soon to do it and have to redo all the wire because of the stuff, they're going to slow walk that redo so much, your thing will be ready for the next century.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. James, I guess it's Emily, and I think it's Emily from Marshall, Texas. What are the five concrete actions that a retired, fixed income, not politically savvy, furious person from Texas can do to make sure this Senate of sycophants gets voted out of beginning in 2026? Yay, Emily.
Yeah, I know where Marshall is. I'm very from Shreveport in East Texas. First of all, and I understand it, you got to try to keep your sanity. And I know if you live in Marshall, there's not a lot of like-minded people as used to, you know, but probably more than you think, and you're probably a little bit of a growing amount. Stay informed, follow things, write when you like something, send a candidate, send an office holder a note. They'll believe me, enough of those, they'll pay attention to it. If you got a little extra change, maybe you might send a check to a worthy candidate here, there, somewhere, try to do it in really competitive districts. And, you know, I think you, in a citizen, someone living in Marshall, Texas, I could make somewhat of a difference, but it requires you to be up to date and follow things and do what you can. Good luck, sister.
Totally agree. And there's nothing against someone from Marshall, Texas.
No.
Sending $5 to a Senate race in Iowa or North Carolina or other places.
Absolutely.
But you know, Emil, I think you may want to save that money for Texas, because I think Texas is a real possibility in 2026. We'll see.
Kent Pax.
Right, exactly. Okay. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, 3-Day Blinds, Naked Wines, and NPR in our episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go and take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.